Right then, the meeting has officially come to order. Let us all say the pledge. I am a nice shark, not a mindless eating machine. If I am to change this image, I must first change myself. Fish are friends, not food.
Kia ora, I'm Davina Zimmer, and despite growing up with the friendly Finding Nemo version of sharks, I am truly terrified of them. I avoid going into the ocean and you won't catch me watching Jaws. So naturally, when Auckland Museum invited us to their new shark exhibition, my colleagues decided I would be the one to go.
Hurry up, he's coming straight for us. Don't screw it up now.
Don't wait for me.
Today on The Detail, from the toothy great white...
They're producing new sets of teeth all the time.
...to the ones that glow in the dark...
They're called lantern sharks because they have these glowing patches on the undersides of their bodies.
...to the smallest one of all.
Cigar shark. They're only about, literally, only the size of a cigar fully grown.
I'm getting up close and personal with these vicious predators to face my fears. Clinton Duffy, the curator of marine biology at the museum, starts me with something easy-ish. The long-extinct Helicoprion, nicknamed the buzzsaw shark.
There's been a lot of debate about what they were, but that it's not a shark. It's a very, very early relative of sharks. It's now thought to be a chimera or a ghost shark, and they diverged. That group of cartilaginous fishes diverged from sharks and rays about 300 million years ago.
The model towers in front of us. Everything here is true to size, and Helicoprions are believed to have been up to 8 metres long, weighing anywhere from 200 to 400 kilos.
So you can still find holocephalans, the ghost sharks, around today, but they don't get anywhere near as big as this, and their jaws aren't quite as fantastic as that.
Because it looks like it's almost got the teeth going along its tongue, like the middle of its tongue.
It's been a lot of debate ever since the very first fossils were found about how it functions and what its purpose was. It's now thought that those teeth rotated backwards into the jaw, into the mouth as the jaw closed. They are actually all in the same plane, just like a circular saw.
Yeah.
It's thought that they impaled prey on the tips of those teeth, and when they closed the mouth, the teeth rotate back in and pulled the prey in, and then they could press up against the roof of the mouth and crush the plip. I think the first fossils that I'm aware of were discovered in Australia, but they're a very old group of animals, and so their fossils tend to be found in places where you've got the very early rocks exposed. So it tend to be places like Australia, Asia and North America.
I've always been intrigued when people find fossils because, you know, obviously no humans were around at that time. How do you decide what they are and give them a name and say, oh, this was this species?
Well, for sharks, which really, for the most part, only leave their teeth behind, it's the shape of the teeth that determines whether or not it's, you can call it a different species. And that really relies on comparing those teeth to modern sharks and seeing how they fit into the jaws. So we have jaw collections here that are used by paleontologists around the world to look at how the teeth of living sharks are set in the jaw today and compare that to the fossils that they've got to determine, is it a different species or is it the same? Because some of our sharks today have actually, like great white sharks and mako, they've been around for millions of years, pretty much as we see them today.
Wow.
Compare that to human beings, I mean, we've been around for about 100,000 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, it's quite amazing to think that animals that we're seeing in the ocean today were swimming around in pretty much that exact form millions of years ago.
The exhibition is split across four rooms, and the one we're currently in has four huge shark models. There's the Helicoprion with the saw-like teeth, followed by a couple of the classics, the hammerhead, the great white, and the tiger shark.
This is a species that visits New Zealand waters in the summertime predominantly. They're a tropical shark. They're potentially becoming more abundant in New Zealand waters over the summertime due to climate change. And there's some evidence now that they may even be breeding in New Zealand waters. In New Zealand, tiger sharks tend to be found further offshore. Certainly adult tiger sharks tend to be found further offshore than they are in the tropics. They are a warm water shark and they're really strongly associated with the East Auckland Current.
So not really a concern of coming across one of these while you're taking a dip this summer?
Not while you're taking a dip, but if you're offshore, you know, game fishermen see them fairly regularly.
Do they specifically go for humans, or is it kind of only if you provoke them?
No. Even the potentially dangerous sharks like great whites and tigers and bull sharks generally don't attack people. You know, more people see them diving than are bitten by them. You know, so globally, there's only between 8 and 20 attacks a year, and there's many, many more interactions with them. We're not part of their normal diet. And most sharks are naturally cautious. You know, you find most predatory animals are cautious, particularly of things that they don't know what they are. And generally, though, sharks will avoid human beings. They do have very sensitive senses of smell, but they generally don't attack people on sight. I mean, I'm not saying they never attack people. They do occasionally attack people because they are designed to feed on prey as large as human beings or bigger. In the case of white sharks, which will feed on small whales and things like that. And that's kind of why we refer to the great white, the tiger and the bull shark as the big three in terms of human shark attacks. But it's perfectly possible to swim with even these potentially dangerous sharks without being attacked. And I've swum now with just over 25 species of sharks and generally had no problems at all.
And you're still here with your limbs.
I still have all my limbs, yes.
Right, and so if we turn around, now this is the one that my nightmares are made of.
Hello.
So the great white, I guess, is kind of the stereotypical shark that we think of, right, when we think sharks.
Yes. And we have, New Zealand is one of the global hotspots for great white sharks. When I was a kid, every great white shark that was ever seen or caught in New Zealand tend to be called a straggler from Australia. But we now know that we have our very own population of great white sharks that we share with Australia. But they are breeding here. They are spending most of their time here. Great whites have one of the broadest temperature tolerances of any species of shark. And they're found everywhere in New Zealand waters, right from the Kermadec Islands right down to Campbell Island. One of the sharks that we tagged off Stewart Island, we nicknamed Ella. She went down to the sub-Antarctic islands, she was as far as Macquarie Island, and she spent a week swimming around in 2.7 degrees Celsius water there. And then she migrated to the Great Barrier Reef, and a month later she was swimming around off Rockhampton in 28 degrees Celsius water. So they have very, very broad thermal niche, mainly because they're warm-blooded. Unlike most sharks, most fish, which are cold-blooded and their body temperature is essentially the same as the surrounding water, great whites and mako and common thresher sharks, they have a heat exchanger system in their muscles that concentrates heat into the core of the body, and it raises their body temperature up to a sort of fairly constant 24 to 26 degrees Celsius. That allows them to be more active predators, allows them to hunt things like seals and small whales in the cold sub-Antarctic waters, but it also means that they're quite at home up in the tropics.
Do they tend to stay in one area or do they tend to swim around? Are they lone?
They do both.
Yeah.
They do both. So the work that we did here, and which has also been done in similar tagging studies, have been done in Australia and South Africa and California, shows that they have the periods of residency. They arrive around the seal colonies at Stewart Island in about December, sort of mid to late December, and the individual sharks can hang around there for 4 or 5 months, and then before migrating up into the tropics. And sharks in New Zealand tend to head to the east coast of Australia and up into the Great Barrier Reef, places like New Caledonia, Fiji, Tonga. We've even had some migrate as far east as the Cooks, and then around about half of them every year are returned to those same places, almost to within the a couple of days. They would be back right there where we saw them the year before.
So is it kind of like they go where the food is?
Yes.
Yeah.
Generally, because a lot of those sharks that we were seeing, making these big movements, they weren't mature. They were sub-adults or juveniles. So those movements obviously aren't related to breeding. We thought initially they were following migrating humpback whales, but the more sharks we tagged, the more we realised they were all doing their own thing.
Between 2005 and 2015, Clinton and his team tagged more than 70 great whites off the coast of Stewart Island.
Most of the sharks we tagged were either with acoustic tags or pop-off satellite tags, which you simply tag with a long tagging pole, and you tag the shark as it swims past the boat. Mm-hmm. Some of the more spatially accurate tags, we had to catch the sharks and bolt the tag onto the shark's dorsal fin.
I see over here, is this a tooth?
A touchable, yes.
Touchable?
It's a scale model of a great white shark's
tooth. So it's not a real tooth?
No.
But, wow, so no, it's about 30 centimetres long and about...
Same wide at the base.
Same wide at the base. And then, so how many of these do they have in their mouth?
So you often hear of sharks having like 300 teeth in their jaws. Yeah, and they do, but most of those are not functional at any one time. So great white sharks have two rows of functional teeth at a time, and they have about 10 to 12 in each side of the jaw. So sharks have sort of hit on this really cool way of ensuring that they can continue to eat throughout their lifetime. So their teeth, they develop in a pocket, a soft pocket in the back of the jaw. They're not embedded in the cartilage of the jaw. They're actually just modified scales. And they have the same sort of internal structure as the denticles growing on the skin on the outside of the shark. So they're basically highly modified denticles. They're just attached to the skin. The skin grows out of that pocket and over the jaw. And as it grows out, it just rotates the teeth forward.
So it's like new sets coming out.
Yeah, new sets. They're producing new sets of teeth all the time. And basically that ensures that any that they break off or lose during feeding will eventually be replaced by a fresh new clean tooth. And when you look at the jaw of a live shark, you will see that they're broken teeth, and there are some that are like just teetering on the edge, just about to fall out. And they do that. So they're able to replace their teeth through their entire lifetime. They do socially interact. So we've often seen juvenile great white sharks with bites that are clearly from much larger great white sharks on their side. We have seen them jaw gaping, flexing their pectoral fins at each other, you know, stiffening up and, you know, yeah, adopting a power stance. And in those social hierarchies, it's usually the biggest shark, which tends to be the mature females that dominate, and everybody else basically keeps out of her way, keeps a respectful distance. But what we noticed when we were working at Stewart Island is when these sharks were first encountering each other, you'd see quite a lot of this jaw gaping and posturing. And then, but after a few days, as they got to know each other and they sorted out that hierarchy, you got much less of that sort of interaction. A lot of the scars that you do see on sharks are defensive wounds by their prey, particularly when they're feeding on seals. They start to get a lot of scars around the eyes and the nose. Mm. You will see quite regularly bites from other great white sharks on them. So the males mate with the females by holding on with their mouths. They bite the female. So you will see females with mating scars. And then occasionally you see a male that may have picked on the wrong female. And
who didn't want a bar of
him. Who didn't want a bar of
Clinton and I head into the room next door. In the centre are two giant curved screens facing each other. On them are animations of hundreds of different shark species.
There's a much greater diversity of forms and lifestyles about sharks than most people realise. So we're standing here and we're looking at this animation of basically showing most of the different forms of sharks. And there's a little shark over there just about to disappear that's a tiny, tiny little thing, which is an animation of a cigar shark, which is the smallest living shark. And, you know, they're only about this, literally only the size of a cigar fully grown, to things like the whale shark, which is, you know, 18 metres long, browny, bluey colour covered with white polka dots. And so the two largest shark species of shark, the whale shark and the basking shark, feed on zooplankton. And then there's this crazy plankton-feeding shark, which was only discovered in the 1980s because it got tangled in the sea anchor of a US destroyer off Hawaii, and they pulled it up. And the megamouth shark, it's this really bizarre, large, it's 5 metres long, deep water shark. It's with a glowing mouth and big rubbery lips.
Wow.
It's quite a bizarre looking animal. We've always known some sharks are luminous, bioluminescent. There's things like the lantern sharks. They're tiny little deep water sharks. They're called lantern sharks because they have these glowing patches on the undersides of their bodies. But, you know, just recently people have discovered, if you by looking at sharks with ultraviolet light and things like that, there's many more of them have either fluoresce or a bioluminescent. It's not something you immediately associate with sharks because we are most familiar with the shallow water ones.
Those are the great whites, the hammerheads and the tiger sharks, the ones with the razor-sharp teeth that feature in films like Jaws.
You're going to need a bigger boat. That's a 20-footer.
25.
But Clinton says in reality, sharks aren't always the predator.
Globally, not doing terribly well. Overfishing is the biggest threat to sharks and rays globally. In New Zealand, most of our shark populations seem to be in pretty good shape. They're not anywhere near as many of them as there used to be before, you know, certainly before industrial scale fishing occurred, but most of them don't appear to be threatened in New Zealand waters.
We do have this social perception of sharks being this scary thing, and so I guess raising awareness about the harm of fishing and the fact that their population is declining is probably hard to kind of get across to people.
Yes.
So they're like, well, these are scary things, don't we want to be rid of them?
Big, strong, you know,
yeah.
Thing. They can look after themselves. Now, some species of shark have gone extinct. There's a species of shark that was described very recently from only three specimens found in museums dotted around the world. It used to live in the South China Sea. You know, a live one hasn't been seen for over 80 years. It's called Carcharhinus obsoletus because it's considered extinct. And so it was actually described after it had gone extinct.
Wow.
So some sharks are in real trouble, particularly freshwater species, but throughout the tropical regions of the world, the shark populations are either overfished or very close to being overfished.
So what do you think needs to happen?
One of the big problems with managing shark fisheries and throughout most of the world is that they're just generally landed as sharks. So they're all lumped together. The different species aren't distinguished in landings, which makes it almost impossible to know what population is doing. So, you know, these species like sharks and rays, which, you know, they're slow growing, they mature late in life, they don't produce a lot of offspring throughout their lifespan. They're naturally very, very vulnerable to overfishing. And if you're going to fish those populations, then they need to be actively managed. You just can't leave it to chance.
And that's what's been happening right now.
It's been happening in many parts of the world.
What is the appeal about fishing for sharks?
It's very hard to know what you're going to catch when you stick a net in the water.
So
generally most sharks are threatened by bycatch, and so they're not deliberately targeted, but, you know, if a fisherman catches it, might as well use it. Many of the large species of shark have to keep swimming to breathe and, you know, ventilate their gills, and as soon as they get caught in a net or on a long line and things like that, they start drowning. And particularly in the tropical regions where the water's really warm, you know, there's often low oxygen to start with, sharks die in fishing gear very rapidly. So even if they're not being used, which is seldom the case, they're generally used for meat and their fins and their skins, they die pretty quickly. Here in New Zealand, we catch about 3,000 tonnes a year of school shark and a similar amount of spotted dogfish or rig, primarily for fish and chips. In other parts of the world, some species of sharks are highly sought after for their meat and highly valued, like the mako shark and thresher shark in the US. They're considered very good eating and are sought after for that reason. But in most other parts of the world, they're just another source of cheap protein.
But not for everyone. The exhibition also explains the deep-rooted connection between sharks and indigenous people around the Pacific Islands and New Zealand, not as a food source, but as taonga.
So that's one of the very cool things about this exhibition is the cultural element, and it sort of takes that relationship between human beings to another level. It looks beyond the shark attack statistics and the bad news fishery stories, and it looks at how important they are to different cultures throughout the Pacific. And, you know, these Pacific people often have very strong connections to sharks and rays, including Māori, who have, you know, got a lot of whakapapa around sharks and rays, and in fact all the marine animals. In some parts of the Pacific, you know, sharks are considered to be atua or gods or ancestors, and some people have them as their are given them as their personal totem when they're born.
As we move towards the end of the exhibition, Clinton shows me a diagram of the ocean's food chain and explains why we need sharks to keep the ocean as it's supposed to be.
Every part of an ecosystem is important. You pull out one piece and you never really know how it's going to respond. And, you know, I guess that's a very simplified diagram of a marine ecosystem and showing some of the interconnections between the different species.
So we've got the shark at the top, and the shark eats
other sharks.
Other sharks, marlin. Sharks kind of eat everything, well, right?
Yeah, some do. Some have very. So that's a tiger shark sitting up there at the top, and they have a very broad diet, everything from crayfish to sea turtles and marine mammals.
I guess people would think that if you get rid of sharks, isn't that good? Because then they don't eat all of these things like tuna and squid.
Yes, but that's, yeah. So, and but we, because we have such a really poor understanding of how these systems work, you're just removing one component of it means you can really tip up the balance. Yeah, so you would think, oh, you know, if we get rid of the sharks, everything's going to be good. But you can get these big population explosions of species that, you know, never caused anybody any trouble before.
Yeah.
Nobody thought that they could actually have it, the impacts they do, because their numbers were being kept under control by the higher level predators. So, yeah, removing large predators, not just sharks, but also, you know, things like swordfishes and, you know, the animals that sit at the top of the food chain can have really unexpected impacts on the ecosystems.
That's all for today. The exhibition opens tomorrow at the Auckland Museum. Thank you to Clinton Duffy for taking me on the tour, and to all the misunderstood sharks out there for keeping our ecosystem churning. The Detail is a newsroom production supported by RNZ and NZ On Air. This episode was produced by Gwen McClure and engineered by Jeremy Ansell. I'm Davina Zimmer. Until next time.